Hotel history is created for adult audiences. Content may not be suitable for all listeners. Discretion is advised. You're listening to Hotel History. We take you with us through the sordid history and scandals of some of the world's most famous and infamous hotels. I'm Dieta.
And I'm Yael. Let's get started.
This episode is all about political hotels, because guess what season we're in?
It's November. It's an election year.
Everyone is going crazy and we need a distraction.
Exactly.
So this is not political as in today, but we're going to go over some very famous, well-known hotels that some political scandals went down.
Yes.
And
Not just scandals, but also historic moments and all kinds of things. So, you know, might as well start with probably the most famous political scandal that has ever happened at an American hotel. And we actually had the pleasure of visiting this hotel in October. It was really exciting to go. And of course, we're talking about Watergate.
Watergate. Watergate. I don't know why I said it that way. And if anyone doesn't know Watergate Hotel, or they only know of the scandal, by the way, it became so famous that no one knew it was a hotel.
Yeah, or at least the younger people didn't, because I certainly did not know that it was a hotel. I just thought it was an office building. I had no idea that it was this entire complex that consisted of hotel and apartments and office building and all of these things.
I actually always thought it was a term used to describe something.
Oh, because it had already become like describing things as whatever gate was already a popular thing whenever we were kids. Yeah.
Yeah. But for those who don't know, this hotel became very infamous after what happened. The hotel became infamous because of President Nixon. And if you don't know who that is, take out your Google.
I thought you were going to say take out your encyclopedia. And
take your, like, your Wikipedia.
Okay,
encyclopedia.
Granny. Yeah.
He was a president. Anyways. the Watergate Hotel, before the Nixon scandal, was apparently very controversial when it opened in 1965. I had no idea it opened then. I thought it opened years before that.
Yeah, no, it was actually still a relatively new hotel when the scandal happened.
So it was new and popular, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So the Watergate Hotel, according to its website, was actually controversial from the beginning of its plans, even. When it opened in 1965, it was designed by celebrity Italian architect Luigi Moretti, and he designed it to be very curvy and sprawling. Like whenever you look at it, a photo of it, you can see just curves. And this was really shocking to Washington, D.C. society. I guess they're so used to all of their like neo Greco-Roman boxy styles of buildings that they just could not like conceive of this modern Italian architecture.
It definitely what is unique even today when you look at it, you go in and it kind of takes you by surprise a little, like, cause it kind of looks boring, I would say sometimes when you're there, or maybe because we went at night, but it has like a very interesting look. And then you kind of look, you notice all the curves more and all the details, it grows on you.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Definitely. It was, it was not at all what I was expecting. I had never seen a photo of it like the from afar, you know, so I had no idea what to expect when we got there, but it was not that.
Yeah. And it also is a complex. So it's not just a hotel, but it has a few other buildings where people did live there. And even though it had, you know, the people critiqued the design that it was very different, it actually became, you know, the playground for a lot of actors and models and congressmen and Supreme Court justices who also lived in the Watergate apartments.
Yes. So it's a group of six different buildings in the Foggy Bottom neighborhood of Washington, D.C. And it's so you don't just have the hotel, but you also have apartments on either side. And then you also have this office building that had a lot of, you know, different companies in it, including which the Democratic National Committee, which will come into play here in the
kind of very important. But the whole thing was built throughout a few years. So it wasn't just built right away.
Yes. Yeah, the hotel itself, I think, opened in 65, and then other buildings started to open up as the years went on.
It says like between 1963 and 1971.
Yeah. But it became an incredibly popular living area, like members of Congress, different members of different presidential administrations. So like it would sometimes be given the nickname like the Little White House because of how many people from an administration were living there. And some famous occupants over time have included Alfred S. Bloomingdale, Bob and Elizabeth Dole, Placido Domingo, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Alan Greenspan, Monica Lewinsky. She stayed there. I guess her mother actually lived there and she stayed there briefly. Robert McNamara, Condoleezza Rice, Ben Stein, and John Warner and Elizabeth Taylor.
Oh, and if you're unfamiliar with a lot of these, you can Google them also.
most of them are political figures with a few celebrities thrown in.
It's hard because I think people who are listening who aren't familiar with like American politics or who are much younger, because I don't even recognize some of these.
Yeah, names. They're going to be like, who is Bob Dole? And why should I get no relation to the banana company?
I was forget about that.
So lots of politicians in here. Surely to God, everyone still remembers Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She hasn't been gone that long.
RBG, they better.
I mean, Condi Rice, you gotta remember her.
I don't think the younger generation knows who any of these people
they are, probably definitely don't know who Ben Stein is.
Who's Ben Stein again?
the clear eyes guy.
I don't know his name.
When your eyes
permanently in my brain.
I mean, he obviously did other things besides eye drops commercials, but that is what he will forever be in my mind as.
So this hotel that was becoming really popular amongst like the DC crowd soon became popular for a different reason. The scandal that overshadowed everything was the Nixon scandal. Let's get into that.
So we're going to kind of try to do like a timeline of events. It's an extremely complicated situation, and we're not going to be able to talk about every single thing that happens, because we do try to keep these a listenable amount. Like you could do an entire podcast probably just on this scandal.
Oh my god, yeah.
But we're gonna do our best to get to hit the important stuff. So
I don't even know it so well, but yeah, go on.
Yeah, so on January 27th, 1972, G. Gordon Liddy, who was the finance counsel for the Committee for the Re-election of the President, also known as CRP, or pronounced CREEP, which is so fitting.
Oh, how appropriate.
and former aide to John Ehrlichman, presented a campaign intelligence plan to CRP's acting chairman, Jeb Stuart Magruder. Great name. Mm-hmm. Magruder sounds like that SNL skit where it's like MacGyver, but the Saturday Night Live version of MacGyver. Do you remember that?
I feel like I do, but for some reason I'm blanking.
I feel like that his name was something close to Magruder. It was like MacGruber or something. Anyway, that is not really good. So G. Gordon Liddy, who, by the way, my entire childhood, I knew G. Gordon Liddy just as that Republican guy who liked to yell on his talk show on the radio. I had no fucking clue that he was a criminal of Watergate fame.
But doesn't it track?
Yes. Yes. But... insane to me, just insane. Anyway, the first time I saw that name, I was like, wait, no, surely not. Yeah, same guy. Anyway, so G. Gordon Liddy is presents some plans to Magruder, the Attorney General John Mitchell, and Presidential Counsel John Dean. Apparently he presented them with several different plans, but this is the one that stuck. The plot involved extensive illegal activities against the Democratic Party. According to Dean, this marked, quote, the opening scene of the worst political scandal of the 20th century and the beginning of the end of the Nixon presidency. So on May 28th, 1972, the plan that G. Gordon Liddy hatched is put into motion. A team of burglars working for President Nixon's re-election campaign, which is organized and led by G. Gordon Liddy, former CIA agents E. Howard Hunt and James McCord, and former FBI agent Alfred C. Baldwin III. They bugged two phones and took photos in and near the Democratic National Committee chairman's office. The phone taps were monitored from Baldwin's hotel rooms, first room 419 and later room 723, at the Howard Johnson's Motor Lodge across the street. So we actually get two hotels for the price of one.
I was going to say a lot of it's involved here.
The wiretap was successful, but soon needed repairs. So the team had to set a second break-in for June 17th, 1972 to replace the malfunctioning phone tap. And while they're in there, you know, collect some more information.
It's still like, I knew the general idea of this, but I'm like, none of these people can claim that they don't know this is illegal. I'm just surprised this is the first time it happened.
That maybe it's not. Sometime after midnight on June 17th, this is their second quote unquote burglary. Watergate complex security guard Frank Willis noticed tape covering the latches on some of the complex's doors leading from the underground parking garage to several offices, which allowed the doors to close but stay unlocked. He removed the tape, believing it was nothing. When he returned a short time later and discovered that someone had retaped the locks, he called the police. Why would there just be, who would just tape a door, like several doors, and that be nothing? Like, too trusting of a security guard.
Yeah.
Police dispatched an unmarked police car with three plainclothes officers, Sergeant Paul W. Leeper, Officer John B. Barrett, and Officer Carl M. Schaffler, sure, who were working the overnight shift. They were often referred to as the bum squad because they often dressed undercover as hippies and were on the lookout for drug deals and other street crimes. Poor hippies.
Oh, yeah. They thought this was something else.
Yeah. So Alfred, so Baldwin, the guy who was staying at the Motor Lodge across the street, he was on spotter duty. So he was supposed to be the lookout across the street, but he was distracted watching Attack of the Puppet People on TV.
Oh my God.
Okay.
How did they know that detail?
It probably was in his interrogation.
It's probably amazing.
Watching Attack of the Puppet People and did not observe the arrival of the police car in front of the building. And he didn't see the plainclothes officers actually investigating the sixth floor where the DNC was. But by the time he did notice unusual activity and radioed his team, it was too late. So the police arrested five men identified as Virgilio Gonzalez, Bernard Barker, James McCord, Eugenio Martinez, and Frank Sturgis. They were criminally charged with attempted burglary and attempted interception of telephone and other communications. The Washington Post reported that the police found lockpicks, door jimmies, almost $2,300 in cash in $100 bills, with the serial numbers in sequence. That's not suspicious. A shortwave receiver that could pick up police calls, which did them no good. 40 rolls of unexposed film, 2 35-millimeter cameras, and 3 pen-sized tear gas guns.
What? That's so specific.
They were so prepared, and all of that did them no good. Like, they still got caught and arrested. And then later, the Post reported that they actually had $5,300 on them. Why would you take your cash to the burglary with you?
I have a lot of questions about the whole thing. Like, was this really worth it?
Yeah. I hope they got paid more than $5,300 between the five of them. Like, I hope the rest of the money was elsewhere.
Because
even in 1972, that's still not enough for five people to burgle the Democratic National Committee.
No way.
So following the apprehension of these five people in the break-in, both the press and the Department of Justice connected the money found on them to the Committee for the Re-election of the President, the fundraising organization of Nixon's re-election campaign. Subsequent investigations and revelations during trials prompted the U.S. House of Representatives to grant the House Judiciary Committee investigative authority, and the Senate established the U.S. Senate Watergate Committee, which conducted hearings related to the incident. So everybody's like, oh, there's something here, and this is not just a burglary, like, there's more going on here. So Nixon's own reaction to the break-in, at least initially, was skeptical. Watergate prosecutor James Neal thought that Nixon hadn't known in advance of the break-in because there was a conversation tape from that was taped on June 23rd between the president and his chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, in which Nixon asked, who was the asshole that did that? So they had this taped conversation where it sounded like Nixon had no idea about it. However,
it sounds staged.
However, Nixon subsequently ordered Haldeman to have the CIA block the FBI's investigation into the source of funding for the burglary. So, way to look innocent. A few days later, Nixon's press secretary, Ron Ziegler, described the event as, quote, a third-rate burglary attempt. On August 29th, at a news conference, Nixon stated that presidential counsel John Dean had conducted a thorough investigation of the incident, even though he had actually not conducted an investigation whatsoever. Nixon also said, quote, I can say categorically that no one in the White House staff, no one in this administration presently employed, was involved in this very bizarre incident. So even with all of this going on, Nixon gets reelected come November in a landslide victory. So everybody, I guess, was just like, oh, poor Nixon. They're picking on him. I guess the scandal just wasn't big enough. Well, also at the time I was reading that the charge of this was kind of being led by the media, and at the time the public, much like now, the public didn't have great trust in the media at this particular time. in U.S. history. And so they were just like, oh, it's the liberal media trying to find any way to bring Nixon down. We don't believe that this, you know, was connected to him. So I'm thinking it's that. So numerous revelations and Nixon's efforts to impede the investigation in 1973 led the House to initiate impeachment proceedings against him. Witnesses testified that Nixon had sanctioned plans to cover up his administration's involvement in the break-in and that there was a voice-activated taping system in the Oval Office. The televised Senate Watergate hearings garnered nationwide attention and public interest. The Supreme Court's ruling in the United States versus Nixon compelled Nixon to surrender the Oval Office tapes, which revealed his complicity in the cover-up. The House Judiciary Committee approved three articles of impeachment against Nixon, who subsequently resigned from office on August 9, 1974, becoming the only U.S. president to do so. His successor, however, Gerald Ford, pardoned him a month later.
Why?
I guess he thought it was just be a disgrace for a president to...
Yeah, his disgrace.
Like, you made your choices, buddy. So, and also, a lot of the tape, even though they did finally, you know, they subpoenaed the tapes and finally got the tapes that had been from the Oval Office, a lot of, like, chunks of the tapes had actually been deleted by Nixon's secretary, who claimed that she had accidentally pushed the pedal that erases tape on her little machine while she was like trying to answer the phone or something, and like they could tell from the setup that is absolutely not, like, that wouldn't have happened, and she was just like, oopsie daisy, I erased some stuff, my bad.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what happened to Nixon after this? He gets pardoned and he just lives on his merry way.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I don't think worked in politics ever again. It's a little hard to come back from that.
Yeah. Oh, shit.
But yeah, like once you're pardoned by the president, you're pardoned. So he didn't have to pay for anything. Everybody else involved did. Like, a lot of people had to, like, were dismissed from the White House. A lot of those people that were involved, he like made them resign or fired them because it was starting to look bad for him. And all of the people involved in the burglary were indicted. The people that they figured out had hired them to do that, like those that I mentioned, like G. Gordon Liddy and Magruder, and all of them, you know, were charged and indicted. Like, so everybody else had to, but even so, I think Magruder only spent like 7 months in prison for his part in it.
Oh.
So even then, like, people didn't get a ton of punishment for...
I feel like that's just like, if you're powerful, you just have that ability to make things disappear for people.
Yeah.
And it's not right.
Absolutely not. Why are you above the law? But yeah, there is a plaque on the sixth floor of the office building portion of the Watergate Hotel commemorating the break-in. And the sixth floor space houses a private exhibit also commemorating the break-in.
So when we went to the hotel, we didn't see it.
No, I think that area was occupied at the time, so they couldn't let us see it. But they did have a separate, smaller little area, like hallway archive kind of dedicated to it as well.
Yeah, that was really nice. And the front desk lady was really nice. She gave us a lot of information, a little tour. And the hotel was just, I really liked it in the end.
Yeah, it's been renovated quite a bit, obviously, since the 70s. And I enjoyed the vibe that they had going on now. Like the downstairs bar area was really cool and fun.
Yeah, the red chairs and the bottles on the wall.
Yeah.
And it was really nice.
They have a rooftop bar.
Yeah. Surprised.
That had a great view of the Potomac and the city, like the Washington skyline. That was nice.
Yeah. And can we talk about the name of the area?
Foggy Bottom?
Mm-hmm. Like, why?
I imagine a lot of fog rolls in off the river.
Oh. I mean, that makes sense. That's a good reason why, but I'm just like, how can you take any place seriously by calling it Foggy Bottom?
That's so true.
Where do you live? I live in Foggy Bottom. Man, it's tough here in Foggy Bottom.
That sounds like a euphemism for something like that a baby has. Like, oh, she had a case of the Foggy Bottoms. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I feel like it doesn't, it's like, but why not just
like, oh, Foggy just Town use some Desitin. That'll clear it right up.
Foggy land,
foggy banks,
foggy banks, or
foggy river. Foggy, like, foggy there's so river, many things. Yeah.
Foggy Bottom. It's like you're just asking for trouble. Like Nixon was like, "This is a great. This is where it's gonna happen." Just, I don't know.
I love it. But yeah, but like you were saying earlier, the name Watergate and the suffix gate have since become synonymous with and applied by journalists to controversial topics and scandals. So it really became intrinsic almost to...
What happened recently that was a gate?
Yeah, there was one not that long ago. Russiagate.
Like a video game gate. Russiagate.
There was Russiagate. Then... There was...
It's like some video game gate.
GameStop gate?
Maybe. There was something else. There's like, but now I hear it. I feel like now.
Yeah. What was, did they name Bill Clinton's scandal a gate?
No, they just, I think that they named that a whore.
A whore gate.
Okay.
I'm cutting that out because Monica Lewinsky doesn't deserve that.
No. Oh. I was not referring to Monica Lewinsky.
Oh, okay.
I was referring to Bill Clinton. Oh, okay, he's good. The whore. No.
Good. Good.
Oh, in my head, I was like, yeah, no, he's the scandal.
So I'm just going to read through some of these famous gates and you guys can if one of these names piques your fancy, you can go look it up. We've got Celeb Gate, Closet Gate, Comics Gate, Donut Gate, Dorito Gate, Driver Gate, Elsa Gate, Gamer Gate. Yeah, so there's so many gates out there. Like, it really just took off as a term. But so yeah, that's the Watergate scandal.
So our next hotel is the Willard, which is also in DC, and we got to visit it. And it was probably one of the most beautiful hotels I've ever seen.
Absolutely gorgeous. If you ever have a chance to go there, it has this beautiful promenade called Peacock Alley, and just insanely gorgeous. It has a really cool little historic archive hallway, just everything you could want.
It has like a little museum in the hotel. It's the ceilings are huge. Everything is so detailed and ornate and beautiful, and you're allowed to like walk around a little. They weren't so don't go there, don't do that.
Yeah, they like really were kind of made it open and inviting for you to check it out. It's known as the most historic hotel in Washington, D.C. So we will probably do a full length on it some point in the future.
It has so much. But we're mentioning this specific hotel because Martin Luther King Jr. finished writing his speech in the lobby. So you can just imagine some of the historical figures that are just hanging out in this lobby. I don't know. I feel like at some point, if you stood there in the 60s, you probably would see like insane amounts of just, I don't know, everyone from history walking through those doors.
Which... Yes, because this hotel is in downtown DC. So it is, you know, very, yeah, very close to the White House and all kinds of political areas. So you're absolutely going to be seeing, you know, political figures, yeah, world leaders.
Yeah, and although everyone calls it the Willard Hotel, apparently the full name is the Willard Intercontinental Washington. Like the Willard is shorter.
Yeah.
It is a historic luxury. I'm not going to say this name right. Beaux Arts. What does that mean? Beaux Arts.
That's the architecture style. Yeah.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Okay. That's very specific because it does have a specific style. It's located, in, as you mentioned, downtown DC, and it was founded in 1847, but it was also, it had many variations. It wasn't all just one hotel and that it just lived on for till now.
In 1816, it started out as a boarding house and then became a hotel, actually became a couple of different hotels, and then until it finally became the Willard in 1847.
Oh, okay. That's where I got confused because I thought it was 1901.
And then current building was erected in 1901. Building. Yeah.
That's the, okay. Yeah. So technically the current building, it's really from 1901.
The current building is, but the hotel, the Willard Hotel has existed since 1847, but it doesn't have to have the same building to be the same entity. The hotel is an entity.
In my head, it does. But you know why it's also confusing? Because when you go into the little museum, it has like a timeline, but it, even in the timeline, it's going back and forth. Like,
yeah,
it's not so easy to follow along. Yeah, so back to Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous speech, I Have a Dream speech, in which King called for equal civil and economic rights and an end to racism in the United States. He delivered that speech to over 250,000 civil rights supporters from the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. I didn't know that's where he did it.
Yeah.
The speech is one of the most famous moments of the civil rights movement and among the most iconic speeches in American history. does anyone not know that speech?
God, I hope not.
I feel like we're entering that era of someone not knowing who MLK is.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what is less known is that he finished that speech in the Willard's lobby in 1963. So imagine... you're writing your most famous speech, and then you're like, gotta finish it. I'm gonna walk to the Lincoln Memorial. I'm kidding. I doubt he was just walking to the Lincoln Memorial by himself.
Oh, definitely not.
So this is interesting. So the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom was partly intended to demonstrate mass support for the civil rights legislation proposed by President John F. Kennedy in June. And King originally designed his speech as a homage to Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address and timed it to correspond with the centennial of the Emancipation Proclamation. Perfect. He knew what he was doing there.
Yeah.
The speech was drafted with the assistance of Stanley Levinson and Clarence Benjamin Jones. Jones had said that the logistical preparations for the march were so burdensome that the speech was not a priority for us. And that on the evening of Tuesday, August 27th, 12 hours before the march, Martin still didn't know what he was going to say. That's actually crazy.
It's crazy, but like, God, do I identify with that? Like, yeah, absolutely. Deadline motivated.
Yeah, but if when it comes from the heart, speeches just like you can prepare 6 months in advance. I never heard like a good speech and they were like, yeah, we knew exactly what we were going to say. It always is like on off the cuff sometimes.
Well, and that's how this ended up going, because even though he did like, you know, write a speech, towards the end of the speech, he went off script and started improvising. And so a lot of what he said towards the end, he pulled from other speeches he had already given, and he just kind of improvised it all together, and it worked out beautifully. I wish that when I improvised, it went that well.
It takes talent. This is really interesting. So why did Dr. King write his speech in the lobby? I didn't know this, but Dr. King wrote the speech in the lobby because the FBI would often bug his hotel room. Oh. And the staff of the Willard gave him seclusion by building a barrier of plants in the lobby so he can work on the speech without notice. And the bellhops and front desk employees would hide him around the lobby, changing his location as he worked. Holy crap. So this is an example of when a hotel actually is helping progress be made again. And it's crazy. It's not just the location, but the assistance of the hotel. Dr. King's family makes pilgrimages to the Willard Intercontinental to mark anniversaries of the March on Washington.
Wow.
Which is so sweet. I hope they treat them nicely. I'm sure they do. The Willard has an MLK suite with a view of Pennsylvania Avenue, which is where the whole place is. But because of renovations, it's not clear which room is actually his in 1963. Yeah, it must have changed a lot since then. But that's crazy. That actually, like, imagine. You see, I knew if you hung out in the lobby long enough back then, you can see something.
Yeah, that. And the lobby is really big. So, like, in my head, if I hadn't been there and someone was just telling me this, I would be like, how big is this lobby that you could hide somebody in it? It's pretty substantial. Like, yeah, you could absolutely move somebody from, you know, corner to corner and put a pretty decent barrier up, and nobody would realize that you had taken part of the lobby away, because there's still plenty of lobby left.
Yeah, and also I don't know how it looked exactly back then. I know now it's like there were a lot of hidden places, right? Yeah. There was that bar. When you go there, you can see there's like another level. You're gonna really hide in some corners in that hotel lobby.
Yeah.
So that's cool of them.
Yeah, that's so cool. And also, I mean, have such an important task at hand, because JFK was really like relying on there being a big turnout to this march to help like put pressure on Congress to pass his civil rights legislation. So to know that like you have a hand in this, and Dr. King was like 16th of 18 speakers, so he's, you know, pretty much one of the headliners, to have that much pressure put on you. And then to also know that the FBI is freaking bugging your room and not even be able to like have a sense of privacy in your own little space that you have in Washington. Just awful.
It's crazy, but good on the Willard. Good on that staff. Like, wow, that's what life's about.
Yeah.
You know, seeing something and doing something.
So that brings us to our final political hotel, which is the Washington Hilton. The Washington Hilton opened in March of 1965. So this is also a fairly new hotel compared to all the historic hotels in Washington. And it opened, it is north of downtown DC. So it's a little bit further out from the White House than like the Willard or the Mayflower. So this hotel was the site of the assassination attempt on President Ronald Reagan by John Hinckley Jr. on March 30th, 1981. As a result, the hotel is sometimes colloquially referred to by the locals as the Hinckley Hilton.
Ooh.
It's kind of cute.
It's kind of cute, but it's kind of also fun.
Yeah. So this story is fucking nuts. I had no idea about some of the details of this. The story starts with Hinckley, our man Hinckley, John Hinckley Jr., Jingleheimer Schmidt, developing erotomania for the child actress Jodie Foster. I didn't know what erotomania was, so I had to look it up.
It's like an obsession, or
you develop this like obsession and this belief that this person who is basically out of your league or would like never notice you or you'd never have a chance with, you develop unrequited love for them. However, you don't really seem to realize that it's unrequited. You think that they secretly love you back. Or if you haven't met them, then you think, oh, if they could just meet you, or if you do this, this thing for them, that they will love you. So while living in Hollywood in the late 70s, Hinckley saw the film Taxi Driver at least 15 times.
Oh my God.
Apparently identifying strongly with protagonist Travis Bickle, portrayed by Robert De Niro. The story involves Bickle's attempts to save a child prostitute played by Foster. Toward the end of the film, Bickle attempts to assassinate a United States senator who is running for president. Over the following years, Hinckley trailed Foster around the country, going so far as to enroll in a writing course at Yale in 1980 after reading in People magazine that she was a student there. He wrote numerous letters and notes to her in late 1980. He called her twice and refused to give up when she indicated that she was not interested in him.
Oh my God.
How did he get her number? Is Jodie Foster's number not unlisted?
You know, this was like 1980. Who knows? Yeah. You know, this guy sounded like he was on a mission.
Yeah, he was going to get a hold of it.
Yeah.
That's crazy. So Hinckley was convinced that he would be Foster's equal if he became a national figure. So he took some inspiration from Taxi Driver and began stalking then President Jimmy Carter. He was surprised how easy it was to get close to the president. He was only a foot away at one event, but he was arrested in October 1980 at Nashville International Airport and fined for illegal possession of a firearm. Carter had made a campaign stop there, but the FBI did not connect this arrest to the president and did not notify the Secret Service.
So the Secret Service issue started way before Trump.
Yeah. His parents briefly placed him under the care of a psychiatrist. So even his parents were like, oh God, oh God, oh God.
They must have known.
Hinckley turned his attention to Ronald Reagan, whose election, he told his parents, would be good for the country. He wrote three or four more notes to Foster in March of 1981. Foster gave these notes to a Yale dean, who gave them to the Yale police, who sought but failed to track Hinckley down. On March 21st, 1981, foreshadowing, new president Ronald Reagan, who had taken office on January 20th, and his wife Nancy visited Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C. for a fundraising event. In his autobiography, Reagan recalled, quote, "I looked up at the presidential box above the stage where Abe Lincoln had been sitting the night he was shot and felt a curious sensation. I thought that even with all the Secret Service protection we now had, it was probably still possible for someone who had enough determination to get close enough to the president to shoot him." How right you are, sir.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So that was March 21st that he went to Ford's Theater and had, you know, was having a moment with Abe Lincoln's box. On March 28th, a week later, Hinckley arrives in Washington, D.C. by bus and checked into the Park Central Hotel. He originally intended to continue on to New Haven in another attempt to infatuate Foster. He noticed Reagan's schedule that was published in the Washington Star and decided it was time to act. Hinckley knew that he might be killed during the assassination attempt, and he wrote but did not mail a letter to Foster about 2 hours prior to his attempt on the president's life. In the letter, he said that he hoped to impress her with the magnitude of his action and that he would, quote, abandon the idea of getting Reagan in a second if I could only win your heart and live out the rest of my life with you. So if only you would love me, I wouldn't have to kill the president.
Oh, God.
On March 30th, Reagan delivered a luncheon address to representatives of AFL-CIO, which is a national trade union center, at the Washington Hilton. The Secret Service was very familiar with this hotel. They inspected it more than 100 times for various presidential visits since the early 70s. It was actually considered the safest venue in Washington because of its secure passageway that was enclosed called President's Walk, built after the 1963 assassination of John F. Kennedy. So Reagan entered the building through the passageway at about 1:45 p.m., waving to a crowd of news media and citizens. The Secret Service had required him to wear a bulletproof vest to some events, but he was not wearing one for this speech because his only public exposure would be the 30 feet between the hotel and his limousine. And the agency did not require vests for agents that day. No one saw Hinckley behaving in an unusual way. Witnesses who reported him as fidgety and agitated apparently had him confused with another person there that the Secret Service had been monitoring. So I guess somebody there was acting weird, but it wasn't Hinckley.
Maybe that other guy was like, I have an idea. Hinckley had the idea. And he's like, you know what? I'm going to go.
So at 2:27 p.m., Reagan exited the hotel through the President's Walk on Florida Avenue, where the reporters waited. He left the T Street Northwest exit toward his waiting limousine as Hinckley waited within the crowd of admirers. The Secret Service had extensively screened those attending the president's speech, but greatly erred by allowing an unscreened group to stand within 15 feet of him behind a rope line. See, why would you do that? Why would you let anyone unscreened anywhere near the president, even if it's only from the hotel exit to the limo? The agency uses multiple layers of protection. Local police in the outer layer briefly check people. Then the Secret Service agents are in the middle layer. They check for weapons. And then more agents form an inner layer immediately around the president. And Hinckley penetrated the first two layers. As several I don't know. They didn't check. As several hundred people applauded Reagan, the president unexpectedly passed right in front of Hinckley. Reporters standing behind a rope barricade 20 feet away asked questions. As Mike Putzel of the Associated Press shouted, "Mr. President," Hinckley assumed a crouched position and rapidly fired a .22 caliber revolver 6 times in 1.7 seconds, missing the president with all 6 shots. But not quite. So the first round hit White House Press Secretary James Brady in the head above his left eye. The small explosive charge in the round exploded on impact. God, that sounds awful. A D.C. police officer, Thomas Delahunty, recognized the sound as a gunshot and turned his head sharply to the left to identify the shooter. And as he did so, he was struck in the back of the neck by the second shot, the bullet ricocheting off his spine. Ugh. So he fell on top of Brady, screaming, "I'm hit." Hinckley now had a clear shot at the president, but Alfred Antonucci, a Cleveland, Ohio labor official who was standing nearby, saw Hinckley fire the first 2 shots. So he hits him in the head and wrestles him to the ground. Upon hearing the shots, special agent in charge Jerry Parr almost instantly grabbed Reagan by the shoulders and dived with him towards the open rear door of the limousine. Agent Ray Shattuck trailed just behind Parr to assist in throwing both men into the car. The third round overshot the president, instead hitting the window of a building across the street. Parr's actions likely saved Reagan from being hit in the head.
Oh, wow.
As Parr pushed Reagan into the limousine, Secret Service agent Tim McCarthy turned his attention toward the sound of the gunfire, pivoted to his right, and placed himself in the line of fire. McCarthy spread his arms and legs, taking a wide stance directly in front of Reagan and Parr to make himself a target. McCarthy was struck in the lower abdomen by the fourth round, the bullet hitting his right lung, diaphragm, and liver. The fifth round hit the bullet-resistant glass of the window on the open rear door of the limo as Reagan and Parr were passing behind it. The sixth and final bullet ricocheted off the armored side of the limousine, passed between the space of the open rear door and vehicle frame, and hit the president in the left underarm. The round grazed a rib and lodged in his lung, causing it to partially collapse before stopping less than an inch from his heart.
Holy. Wow.
Damn. Okay, first off, the fact that that dude managed to get off six shots and didn't directly hit.
Okay. He's not a good shot.
Yeah,
apparently.
Like he was right to think that he might not make it out of that situation alive. Like he had not practiced nearly enough, thank God. Thankfully, a fast thinking from everyone around, and that people, you know, didn't run, you know, didn't just run away. They actually like saw Hinckley and tried to take him down.
Yeah, his Secret Service agent Tim McCarthy.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, that so like you've got the Secret Service agents grabbing the president and getting him away, one like acting as a human shield, but then also the there were two citizens like that were there for the speech, like not Secret Service people, that beat the crap out of Hinckley and were like taking him to the ground.
That is that how he got caught, right?
Yeah, he got caught. Right. For
I was saying,
sure.
Like,
So within moments of the first shot, a different Secret Service agent, Dennis McCarthy, no relation to the other McCarthy, dove across the sidewalk and landed directly on Hinckley as others pushed Hinckley to the ground. Another Cleveland area labor official, Frank J. McNamara, joined Antonucci and started punching Hinckley in the head. Dennis McCarthy later reported that he had to strike two citizens to force them to release Hinckley. So they were just going to beat him till he died, it sounds like. Secret Service agent Robert Wanko deployed an Uzi concealed in a briefcase to cover the president's evacuation. So they brought out the big gun for that. And to deter a potential group attack.
Wow.
Man, that is some action. So the day after the shooting, Hinckley's gun was given to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which traced its origin in just 16 minutes. They figured out that the gun had been purchased at Rocky's Pawn Shop in Dallas, Texas, in October of 1980. What a surprise. Surprise, surprise.
Texas is at it again.
It had been loaded with six Devastator brand cartridges, which contained small aluminum and lead azide explosive charges designed to explode on contact. But the bullet that hit Brady was the only one that exploded. Oh, on April 2nd, after learning that the other bullets could explode at any time, volunteer doctors wearing bulletproof vests removed the bullet from Delahanty's neck. Oh my God. So anybody with a bullet still in them is like a ticking time bomb because it could explode any time. Oh. So
that's crazy.
After the Secret Service first announced shots fired over its radio network, Reagan, whose code name was Rawhide, was removed from the scene. Why is that his name?
Why is that his name?
He was removed from the scene by agents in the limousine, which was nicknamed Stagecoach. No one knew that Reagan had been shot. After Parr searched Reagan's body and found no blood, he stated that Rawhide is okay. We're going to Crown, which is the White House. He preferred the White House's medical facilities to those of an unsecured hospital. But Reagan was in great pain from the bullet that had struck his rib and believed that his rib, he thought that his rib had cracked when Parr pushed him into the limousine. So they didn't realize yet that he had been shot. But when the agent checked him for gunshot wounds, Reagan started coughing up blood.
Oh, no.
So the president thought he had cut his lip, but Parr assessed that the cracked rib had punctured Reagan's lung. And so then they diverted to George Washington University Hospital, which the Secret Service periodically inspected just in case they needed it. So the limousine arrived there less than 4 minutes after leaving the hotel, while other agents took Hinckley to a DC jail, and Nancy Reagan, codename Rainbow, left the White House for the hospital.
Wow. They need to make a movie about this.
I think they did. I'm sure they did.
They did?
I feel like there is one. We'll Google it. Although Parr had requested a stretcher, none were ready at the hospital, which did not normally station a stretcher at the emergency entrance. Reagan exited the limousine and insisted on walking. He acted casually and smiled at onlookers as he entered the hospital. When he entered the hospital, he started having difficulty breathing and he fell to one knee. So then they assisted him the rest of the way. The physician to the president, Daniel Rouge, had been near Reagan during the shooting and arrived in a separate car. Believing that the president might have experienced a heart attack, Rouge insisted that the hospital's trauma team operate on Reagan as they would any other patient. When a hospital employee asked Reagan aid, Michael Deaver, for the patient's name and address, only when Deaver stated 1600 Pennsylvania did the worker realize that the president was in the emergency department. My God. The medical team cut Reagan's $1,000 custom-made suit in order to examine him. Reagan complained about the cost of the ruined suit, which was cited by an assistant to a press brief in a press briefing to reassure the public that the president was in stable health. Military officers, including the one who carried the nuclear football, you know, the case with all of stuff in it.
Yeah,
they unsuccessfully tried to prevent the FBI agents from confiscating the suit that was cut off of him because Reagan's wallet and other possessions were in the suit, which they were confiscating as evidence. But the gold codes card that has the nuclear codes on it was in Reagan's wallet. So the military is like trying to stop the FBI from taking this wallet with the golden codes in it. And they did not manage to stop them. And the FBI didn't return it for 2 days. So I imagine the Pentagon was shitting a brick.
Oh, my God. Well, how are they so... Just so many questions. Like, first of all, why does the president have a wallet other than that?
To carry the gold codes.
Yeah, other than just have a gold code. Tissue or something, but like a whole wallet. What are you buying? No one's gonna let you buy it.
The medical personnel found that Reagan's systolic blood pressure was 60 compared to the normal 140, indicating that he was in shock. And they knew that most 70-year-olds in the president's condition would not survive. But Reagan was in excellent physical health and had been shot by a .22 caliber bullet instead of a larger .38, as they first feared. So they were able to operate on him and everything turned out okay. When Nancy Reagan arrived in the emergency room, Reagan remarked to her, "Honey, I forgot to duck." Borrowing boxer Jack Dempsey's line to his wife. While intubated, he scribbled to a nurse, quote, "All in all, I'd rather be in Philadelphia," borrowing a line from W.C. Fields. Although Reagan came close to death, the team's quick action and Parr's decision to drive to the hospital instead of the White House likely saved his life. Within 30 minutes, Reagan left the emergency department for surgery with normal blood pressure. So he then had his emergency exploratory surgery to make sure all of his organs were okay and remove the bullet. He lost over half of his blood volume in the emergency department and during surgery.
Oh,
yikes. But the bullet was successfully removed and he was okay. In the OR, Reagan removed his oxygen mask to joke, "I hope you are all Republicans." And the doctor... And the doctors and nurses laughed, and the surgeon, who was a Democrat, replied, "Today, Mr. President, we are all Republicans." Meanwhile, the FBI took over the investigation, and on Saturday, agents obtained a warrant and searched Hinckley's hotel room. According to agent Thomas J. Baker, quote, "What we found in Mr. Hinckley's room was bizarre. On the desk, so that we could find him, was his entire plan. He had left a map of where he was going. He had the morning paper open with the president's diary. He publicized the fact that Reagan would be speaking to a union group in the ballroom of the Washington Hilton. Strangest of all was a statement, a letter to actress Jodie Foster proclaiming that he was committing a historic act, a presidential assassination, to impress her," end quote. According to Baker, our follow-up investigation, which lasted weeks, traced Mr. Hinckley's history over the previous months. We determined that he had traveled the country, gone to firing ranges, and in fact was obsessed with Miss Foster. He had planned and committed an assassination attempt on the president. He was a mentally disturbed man.
Oh, yeah. No shit.
That is an understatement.
I have a question. Did Jodie Foster put out a statement like, "Oh, I'm so sorry"?
Good question.
I would be like horrified if someone did that to me, or not to me, but used me as an excuse to do that to someone else.
Oh my God.
And especially the president. I would be so horrified.
Let's see. The first result is a article entitled, load please, "Jodie Foster and the Trauma That Has Stopped Her Doing Theater for 40 Years. The actress has always avoided speaking out about the stalker who shot Ronald Reagan in a bid to impress her until now. She was 18 at the time of the shooting and has never since returned to the stage." So this is an article from El País. Wow. So definitely had an effect on her.
Yeah.
So Hinckley apparently was quoted as stating that the shooting was, quote, "the greatest love offering in the history of the world." Ugh.
Ew.
Yuck.
I also like, I don't know Jodie Foster as like the young 1970s actress. I know her as, you know, the older actress in Panic Room and
Silence of the Lambs
and Silence of the Lambs. And like, I also just watched The True Detective Night Country. It was really good. But it's weird. It's weird that someone would be, it sounds bad, like so obsessed with her. I mean, she's amazing. She's an amazing actress, but still it's like, it's just bizarre.
It's crazy. So apparently she was in college, you know, she's in college at this time, and she was in theater in college and was in doing this play. The play happened in 2 weekends, and I did the first weekend. And in between the first weekend and the second weekend, John Hinckley shot the president, she says. So for years, she introduced clauses in her media interviews that prohibited any mention of the subject. So she would not talk about it for 4 decades, basically. Then she says, "The world fell apart. There were Secret Service people everywhere. I had bodyguards and I had to be taken to a safe house. And I was in the middle of these 2 weekends of this play. And I had the dumb idea of the show must go on. So I was like, I have to do that second weekend." However, Foster says that during that second weekend, there was a terrifying incident that left her traumatized. "There were people everywhere, cameras everywhere, and there was a guy in the front row. And I had noticed that it was the second night that he'd been there. And I decided to, the whole play, yell, 'Fuck you, motherfucker!' I just decided that I was going to use this guy," she says. "And then the next day, it was revealed that this particular guy had a gun and he had brought it to the performance. And then he was on the run and I was in a class and the bodyguard guy came and threw me onto the ground while I was in the class, which was really embarrassing because there were only 10 people there." Wow. She reflects, it was a traumatic moment, and I've never admitted that maybe that has something to do with how I never wanted to do a play again. Well, yeah. Oh
my God. I never want to, do anything again.
Did you know that Hinckley was granted probation in 2016?
What?
Yeah. What? After years of successive prison benefits, Hinckley was granted probation in 2016.
Did he get it?
Yeah.
Is he free?
Hinckley, so when was this article written? This article is from this year. This is from June of this year. It says, Hinckley, who is now 69 years old, he was 25 when he shot the president, was fully released from court restrictions in June 2022. A few days later, he had his first TV interview with CBS. In the interview, of course he did. In the interview, he expressed remorse for his actions and said that he did not remember what feelings led him to shoot Reagan.
Oh, okay.
He also said he was sorry for all the lives affected by his actions and apologized to his family, Reagan, and the family of James Brady, the White House press secretary who was hit in the head by a bullet and left partially paralyzed for life. He also asked Foster for forgiveness. I know that they probably can't forgive me now, but I just want them to know that I am sorry for what I did. When asked what led him to shoot the president, he did not mention his obsession with the actress and simply replied, quote, it's something I don't want to remember. Damn.
I can't believe that this man is walking.
Yeah.
Like, as a free man, because you can't just try to kill the president and everything.
You can't just try to kill the president and not have to be in prison forever.
Forever. Yeah.
Forever. Like, Jesus, if the president can't even keep his attempted murderer behind bars, then what luck will the rest of us have?
Oh my God. If I was Jodie Foster, I'd be terrified.
Oh my, yeah.
That's so dangerous. What about if he gets his obsession again?
Yeah, like, it sounds like he doesn't, like, maybe he's, I'm sure he's had, I hope he's had a ton of therapy in the 40 years or whatever that he was in prison, but.
Yeah, no, there's.
So I don't know very much about erotomania. Erotomania? Is that how you say it?
Yeah, I think so.
But is it curable? Like,
I don't think it matters. Like,
I'm sure it doesn't matter to Jodie Foster.
No. It's like your brain is not normal. So you can probably be susceptible to some other mania.
Yeah.
No, or whatever. I'm not a doctor, but all I know is that man should be behind closed doors. I have a question. Is he going to be banned from the Washington Hilton if he ever goes there?
I hope he is banned from Washington, D.C. entirely.
I don't imagine he just wants to just visit it.
He hasn't been to any Trump rallies lately, has he?
They got to check all the roofs now.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh. There's a new threat in town.
I mean, he was pretty good at getting pretty damn close to the president, to two presidents. He got to within a foot of Jimmy Carter.
Oh, yeah. But this was a long time ago. I feel like things changed.
Yeah, but the assassination of JFK was still pretty fresh. Like, that happened in 63. You know, this is happening in 1981. So, you know, it even though it's been a minute since a president has been assassinated, it's still much fresher to them than it is to us.
Yeah, that's true. So out of all the scandals, what do you think is the biggest one? I gotta say, I think the assassination.
Yeah, you know, I really thought that Watergate was gonna be the big one, but I think the assassination attempt.
Yeah, it's way more shocking.
Yeah.
And crazy.
Yeah, because I mean, I guess attempted murder is always a bigger deal than attempting to steal information from the Democratic National Committee.
Yeah. I feel like today it would be so much easier. They were just like,
you just need a good hacker.
Well, also they let everyone's online. You know, you can just like catfish a Democratic whatever. So we went to DC recently, and we have an upcoming episode with the Mayflower Hotel. We have a collaboration with them, but we got to see all these other hotels. And I guess without giving too much away, is there any story with the Mayflower we can mention?
Oh man, there's going to be so many great stories whenever we do the episodes that I'm pretty sure is going to be a multiple part series for the Mayflower. You know, I really love the story. Just like to give you a little teaser, there will be espionage for sure.
Oh,
from World War II. There's some really cool stories with that, not just about actual spies staying at the Mayflower, but also with spy training happening.
And every single, I feel like every president has stayed there, but for like some, it's not that scandalous. I don't think it's that scandalous, but who am I to judge? But they say that when Trump made a speech there, that they saw the rumors of like the Russian guy.
Like the Russian ambassador or something was in the hotel at the same time. And so, that's supposed to be tied into the whole Russian collusion.
But then it wasn't really. Because the guy's like, they didn't really talk. And then he quickly left or something.
Yeah.
So it wasn't as scandalous as it sounds. And then I think in the book it mentions that, because there is a book talking about history there, and they mentioned JFK stayed there, and there's a rumor that Marilyn Monroe stayed there at the same time, and that, you know.
Oh, yeah. And so, you know, he would have needed to be able to sneak her into his room if they were staying there at the same time for their illicit affair.
It's possible.
It is possible because, you know, hotels have lots and lots of little back way routes that the public doesn't get to see. So it's totally possible that something like that could have happened.
I wonder, you'd have to like be a detective and find the old ledgers and like, what year it was, what month it was. Like, did they even know each other then? Or was it just, because a lot of famous people did stay in the same place at the same time.
So it could absolutely just be coincidence that these two well-known people who have been linked romantically might have just by coincidence stayed there at the same time.
Oh, but we know the hotel also has some other scandal with Elliot Spitzer. He was governor of New York, I think, right?
I think, yeah.
And
you know we love a good prostitute story.
Yeah. And this guy who's so anti-prostitution, well, guess what he's spending his money at? Prostitutes.
He's projecting.
Of course he's projecting. You know, it was so... You know Anthony Weiner? So he was my congressman in New York. And he would go to all the high school graduations. He was at my high school graduation.
Wow.
And you know what I realized about Anthony Weiner and Dick Cheney and George Bush and the Boner guy? Boner guy? The last name with the Boner Boner? Yeah. I have a theory. Don't vote for a president that has genitalia in their name.
Crazy.
It's just a bad policy.
Logic.
Just, just logical. Stay away from it. Like,
I like that you're lumping George Bush into that.
I'm sorry. Hello. Is it not correct?
Once you've put him into the category with all the others, absolutely. I don't know that I would have come up with that, like, that particular type of Bush right off the bat.
Is that not what people think when they hear his name? That is the only thing I think about when I hear his name. Like, there's one Bush. It's like, you should be embarrassed by that. And then you're the craziest thing, your last name is Bush and then your VP's Dick. Come on.
Yeah. I mean, that together, absolutely. Yeah.
It's just the jokes write themselves.
So yeah. There you have it, folks.
I hope we lightened up this very tense election cycle. It puts a smile on your face, and when you feel like the world is falling apart,
burning down around you,
just remember
that we can't take anything seriously.
Yeah, we didn't start the fire.
But our president was a burning bush. Yeah. I was trying to connect that in there somewhere. I don't think it landed. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Hotel History. You can follow us on most social media platforms, Patreon, and Substack by searching for Hotel History or Hotel History Podcast. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify so we can reach more listeners.